Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Julia LaRoche Show. I am so pleased to bring to you this episode with Bill Fleckenstein, president and founder of Fleckenstein Capital. In this episode, we get the legendary fund manager's macro outlook and the two big things that matter right now, which is the Fed and the passive bid, both of which are warping markets. We also got his take on his endgame thesis, where the bond market, especially the long end of the bond market, will signal that it no longer trusts the Fed. He explains what that means and how that might play out. We also got into precious metals, including what the gold market is sniffing out right now, silver, and his longer-term outlook for the U.S., given the extraordinary levels of debt. I really enjoyed this conversation with Bill. I learned a lot from him, and I think you will too. Bill Fleckenstein, president and founder of Fleckenstein Capital. It is an absolute honor to welcome you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today, Bill.
Well, thanks for having me. I hope you don't ask any questions that are too hard.
Well, I think you can handle it. And I have to say, Bill, I'm really excited to have you on because your name comes up all the time from the audience in their guest request. So that just makes me so happy to be able to bring someone that I know they are going to love to learn from. And Bill, one of the things about this show is I always start with the big picture macro view, the framework in which you are looking at the world today. And one of the things about the show, Bill, is you can take all the time you need to set the table when it comes to that macro picture.
Okay. Well, I start from the premise of what the Federal Reserve does really matters. And unfortunately, we have a organization that is essentially incompetent running monetary policy. It's been a slow degradation from when Greenspan started in the late 80s. He was okay for 5 or 6 years, and then he started to kind of believe his own BS and started to pursue policies that I thought were on the reckless side, although compared to what eventually has happened, that was all kid stuff. But if we recap, we had the equity bubble that was caused by incompetent monetary policy, and the Y2K liquidity injection in the end is what blew the top off the stock market in 99 and set up for the collapse in 2000. Regretfully, 9/11 came along. It was obviously horrible for the people involved. It was also unfortunate because the recession that we had was underway already as a consequence of the burst bubble. So the Fed escaped blame for that, and it didn't take them very long to create another bubble, this one in real estate. Meanwhile, they did not adequately supervise the banks, who the supervisory role which they had taken on when Greenspan got Glass-Steagall repealed in 1998. So we had two bubbles. And in the wake of almost imploding the financial system and the real estate bubble, they started QE. And QE led to more QE and not so much QT, and led to ZIRP, zero interest rates, during the COVID mania craze. And so what we have is a Federal Reserve that has created two huge bubbles and a lot of misallocated capital, and has enabled an enormous amount of can-kicking on the part of the government. It's one of the reasons we can have as much debt as we have today and have politicians not feel like there's any limit to how much debt they can run up or how badly the budget can be out of balance, because there's been no consequence to that. So we have a central bank that is a bubble-blowing, enabling monetary mechanism, and the G7 central banks aren't that much different. So that is an unhealthy framework, though it does create a lot of equity, say, wildness, which people appreciate. They don't like so much. It's like getting drunk. You know, people don't complain so much when they're drinking and getting, you know, all happy and high, but the next day they don't always feel so well. We haven't felt too much of the downside. I mean, you know, $8 trillion or $7 or $8 trillion of the federal debt is on the Fed's balance sheet. They still, you know, they're never going to get that down very far. So that's an unhealthy environment. The other development that is mandatory that people understand is the power of the passive bid. What do I mean when I say that? I don't mean an ETF where you give money to the ETF and it then blindly goes and buys the stocks in that ETF according to the weightings that they have. Or anyway, what I'm talking about is the defined contribution plans, 401k plans, and those sorts of things, where corporate America sets aside money for your retirement and you match and they match that money. That has had an amazing distorting effect on the market. You may or may not know Mike Green. For all I know, you've talked to him.
Oh, yes, he's been on, yeah.
Okay, well, he's the expert. So everything I know about that, I learned from him. But when you're trying to understand the game that you're playing, you're playing a game that's been wildly warped by the Fed and by passive bid. Some point, both of those are going to become a problem. I don't know when, but the reason I bring this up is because you have to have that in the back of your mind when you're setting yourself up for your portfolio or how much risk you want to take or understanding how much risk you are taking. So not going into a ton more detail, those are the two big things that I think matter. Then you have to understand where you are in the business cycle, what the Fed's liable to do, you know, things like that. But the investment business, as it has sort of been, sort of as it's existed in the market since really QE and the real rise of passive, which is now about half the market activity, depending on how you measure it, has had a tremendous impact on changing the kinds of things that work and what doesn't work and how high valuations can get on certain things. So anyway, those are my biases.
Wow, what a great framework. I'm so excited to dive in with you, Bill. Okay, so those are the two big things that matter, the Fed warping the markets and the passive bid. And you were just mentioning there that it's changed the investment business and, you know, what's worked and what doesn't work. Can you give us a bit more detail there? Because you've been in markets for a long time. Would love to just kind of understand that.
Okay, so when I first got in the investment business was in 1980. I was a broker, and if there had been a really bad bear market in 73, 74, and the 70s were not particularly great period for equities in America because of inflation and then ultimately high interest rates. So the people that survived were really pretty good at being two or three steps ahead of the crowd. And the investment business used to be all about, you know, figuring out things before other people. And then when you thought that you had to figure out, okay, now whatever I own is done enough or it's all it's going to do, and then move on to the next thing. And so it used to be that the stock market was a tremendous discounting mechanism, not just the market itself, but individual companies, industries. You know, the tape, an industry would start down while the news was still good, and you'd look back and say, oh, they saw this coming or something like that. That has not really been the case in the last 10 or 15 years. It's almost like the stock market has become a lagging indicator. And that's for two reasons. Number one, because the passive bid has gained dominance and it's done well. It's kind of like a momentum voting machine is what it is. And if you're the active managers don't think that way. I mean, the passive bid doesn't think. It says, I have money, I buy according to the statistics. I don't care if something sells at 5x earnings or 5 million times earnings, I'm buying it. And I make no judgments. All of that was predicated on John Bogle's theory that, hey, look, the market is smart. Market figures things out. So we're not going to try to beat all these smart people. We're just going to go along for the ride. The flaw in that is once you get so big that you distort it and you put those smart people that you thought were leading the market in the right way out of business, now you admittedly don't know anything, don't do anything, just buy them and sell them whenever you get or don't have money. Now you're leading the charge. And so that's how you get these crazy situations where we have these epic valuations where a company like Apple, which hasn't grown in what, 12, 18 months, you know, sells at 25x earnings and has a $2.5 trillion market cap. I mean, that could never have happened in the past. But it can now. And so I could give plenty of other examples. So the supposed thoughtful people that this whole theory of passive investing was built on are slowly being driven out of the business. And so you have this, you know, the tail wagging the dog, so to speak, which is why if you think back to when the market broke in March of 2020, it was clear that there was a virus in China that was really potentially super dangerous. It seemed way more dangerous in the beginning than we realized it was about 6 months later, but that's a different issue. In the past, our market would have started down, but in fact, it took like, you know, the thing had, we had practically have an outbreak here in America before the market started down. That's the kind of thing that I mean. So the way you invest, you have to be a little more circumspect about what it's going to take maybe to get, you know, your ideas, you know, when other people are going to figure out what you figured out already, which is the idea of getting there early, right?
That is so fascinating. Let me ask you one more question, just like on the market, specifically equity markets. And you're someone who has, you know, called out some major bubbles in your career. When you look at the markets today, do you think the markets, is it fair to say they are in a bubble? Are we in that kind of territory? Would love to get your perspective there.
You know, so I sort of define a bubble as something where the bubble itself warps the behavior of the participants. So, you know, in the late 90s stock bubble, we had people who really knew nothing about stocks deciding they had to quit their jobs and day trade. And then you could look at outlandish valuation and pets.com and all the examples. The real estate bubble, same thing happened. You know, people thought that their house would go up in value and they could take money out and nothing could go wrong. They could buy other houses and it warped the underlying economy. What we have today is, it's not a bubble in that sense, I don't believe. I believe there's plenty of misallocated capital, but it's not like it can change overnight. Like the equity bubble, you know, came apart in March of 2000 after the Y2K injection had been pulled back out, and the real estate market exhausted itself in mid early 2007 when the first payment defaults hit. So you could tell that the mania had exhausted itself. This isn't really a mania that's driven the market. It's the passive bid that has warped things, and it won't unwind in the same way a naturally occurring event in a market will. So you have to know this. You have to look for signs that something has been disrupted in the passive bid. Mike Green feels it will probably require a higher rate of unemployment, and I don't see any reason to disagree with him on that. So it's something you have to know, and you have to be aware of the potential dangers, but you can't, it's not something you can really worry about on a day-to-day basis, because it's not going to change its mind. You know, the massive madness of the crowds can change their mind, right? But this can't happen. So while there are no shortage of insane things occurring, whether you want to talk about Dogecoin or the valuation of these mega cap stocks or the insanity over generative AI, there are aspects of bubble-like behavior, but it's not the same as Tokyo in the late 80s or the other two bubbles that we had, in my opinion.
Got it. It's interesting, the notion of the stock market is a lagging indicator. Are there other assets, though, that are still, are they more leading indicators? Or are there other assets you look at that are kind of sniffing out the reality of the situation, or like what's actually happening in the economy? Would love, I don't know if that's a good question or not.
No,
but
it's a great question. Not really. I mean, the bond market has always sort of been captured, you know, by the Fed at the short end. Now, the long end of the bond market can dance to its own drummer. And I think eventually we will see a situation where somewhere down the road, whether it's 2 weeks from now or a year from now, the Fed will try to ease, thinking that they've got inflation conquered, when they haven't really changed inflation psychology, which is the part of the equation people don't talk about. And we'll get into a situation where they've lowered short rates, and after maybe a little while, the long end of the bond market rates rise, like the long end doesn't trust the Fed. I've always thought that was the end game for the reckless experiment that the Fed has been on for the last 25 plus years. And we'll see if it plays out that way. But no, I don't think there's that many. I don't know where the best discounting mechanism is these days. Because you know the economic data is still there, and there are leading indicators, economic data. But a lot of people have been fooled in this cycle because we haven't had a cycle where we've had this high of a budget deficit stimulating the economy outside of a recession. So now the signals that we might have used and trusted for the last 25 years don't work very well right now. And so you just kind of have to be aware that things are a little bit different.
Yeah. A couple of things threads I want to pull on. They're just interesting curiosities to me and would love for you to explain. I was just taking some notes. You're saying like the long end of the bond market, what the end game would be that it doesn't trust the Fed.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me like sure. in a really easy to understand way?
Thank you mean you. Like you're 5 years old?
I mean, like, yeah, or fifth grader. No, I'm just...
Fair enough. I mean, I throw these things around because I've thought of them a lot, and I can appreciate the fact that it's not intuitively obvious. So what everyone who's got less gray hair than me has seen for the last 25 years or 20, 30 years, really, is the Fed cuts rates. People assume they know what they're doing. The short end comes down, short rates come down, twos, fives, tens, twenties, rates come down, the yield curve comes down. What they haven't seen is following. Fed cuts rates and the yield curve rallies, the curve comes down, rates come down. And then after a time, longer rates start to back up. So let's say rates are, five-ish right now. Let's say that everything is flat across the curve. So let's say we get into the Fed starts cutting in 6 months or 3 months because some data was weak. And let's say they take rates down to, I'm going to give a ridiculous example to make the point. Let's say they cut rates 200 basis points, they go down and short rates are 3 and the 2 years at 325 and the 5 years at 350. But all of a sudden the 10 and 20 don't come down as much and instead start to go back up. So there would be a knee-jerk reaction at first, but those longer rates back up because you can own a two-year piece of paper and say, if the Fed screws it up and create more inflation, I'm not trapped for very long. If I get it wrong, I can't lose that much principal in the interim if I have to sell my bond. But if they're trying to get you to buy 10, 20-year paper, you can say, wait a second, this is going to lead to more inflation. So in the short run, yes, rates have come down and arguably... longer term bonds should not yield 5, they should yield 4.5. But that's the old regime. Now the bond market is saying, we don't trust that you're going to have inflation under control. So if we're going to buy 30-year paper, we're not going to pay 5. Sorry, we're not going to be willing to have you give us 5. We want 5.50 or 6 or some number like that. It's where the long end doesn't cooperate with the Fed's wishes. That's not something anyone's seen really since the 70s. Oh, you could say the early 80s, actually. Yeah, you could say the early 80s.
Got it. Well, we're recording this the day of the CPI print came out this morning, a hotter print. And I wrote down another thing that was interesting. You said the inflation psychology part that people don't talk about. I'd love to explore that too. Maybe get your reaction to the CPI inflation today, but that was interesting, the psychology part.
That's the part that people that have it, so we haven't really had inflation that's disturbed anyone in this country really since the late 70s, early 80s. So, and while I wrote a book about the Fed called Greenspan's Bubbles, The Age of Ignorance of the Federal Reserve. And one of the chapters I talked about how inaccurate the CPI is as a statistic, both because of hedonics, substitution, then you have owner's equivalent rent. Hedonics is the real one, but that's where they say, well, you bought this new car. Yeah, it went up 20% in price, but you got 25% more stuff for it, so it really went down in price. That's what hedonics is. And I'm not making this up. I mean, that's a fact. So we had more CPI inflation than I think that, you know, the average, than the data showed. And everyone's inflation experience is different because you have more money, you have kids, you don't have kids, you're older, you're younger, you know, a lot of things. But it was never bad enough that people felt like it was inevitable that it might really be a problem. And so, and financial assets did well. So if you thought that maybe the Fed was, maybe rates were a little too low and there was a little more inflation than the government said, it didn't really impact you because your financial assets are doing well, your job, you're doing okay. So it did. People didn't think about the prices were going to go up and stay up and continue to go up. That's a psychological thing. The first time we started to see anything like that since the 70s was when the first shortages hit, when the COVID lockdowns began. And all of a sudden, people realized, oh my God, I might not be able to buy any of this. Or, oh my God, it might be up a bunch in price. And then in the wake of the lockdowns and all of that, and the supply chain disruptions, and now the trade friction with some of the world, so we're reshoring, so it creates disruptions. But there are all manner of price hikes that go on along the whole food chain. And now I think people have come to expect them, and they don't quite believe that the Fed can get it under control. If you weren't around at the time and saw what Volcker had to do to break the back of inflation, I see people that I know are very smart, who I respect a great deal, who have had this whole inflation, this whole period post-COVID wrong from an inflation standpoint, because they said it was transitory. And what they meant by transitory was, well, prices go up a whole bunch, and that'd be a one-off, and then they'd slowly drift back down. But that's not what's happened. They went up a bunch, and they've come. Some things have come down more than others, but we're not on a path that we're not going to get all those price hikes back. And in fact, prices may start to tick up some, right? So, and the longer that goes on, the more people see that, the more they begin to think, hey, that's going to be the way it is. I can't trust that inflation will come back down, and they don't see any signs of it. And so psychology shifts. It's a very, very powerful when people decide that something is going to have an outcome like that, and it can run for a long time. Breaking that inflation psychology was what Volcker managed to do, and it was rather difficult. Short rates went to 20% roughly. I think the high tick in long-term government bonds, 20-year bonds then was the longest, was almost 16%. And people didn't believe it. In fact, in October of 1979, Volcker hiked rates 200 basis points on a Saturday in October. And in the next 3 months, the price of gold doubled because the gold market didn't believe him. People that didn't believe him tended to own gold and inflation hedges, and the gold market doubled. Now, that was it. Gold peaked out at 800 and change in January of 1980, and by 2000, it was $300 again. So it took really until 84 for inflation psychology to totally get back under control, but I don't want to bore people with all that ancient history. What I'm trying to say is that if you haven't read about history and really immersed yourself in a financial history book and see what happens in those periods, you're not going to understand what's liable to happen now. So I believe inflation is going to be a problem for some time. I don't know what the amplitude of it will be because it kind of depends on how events go. But the Fed is not going to get to 2% inflation. And the real question is, how far they're willing to bend that stated claim before they cut? And we don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, well, I have to say, Bill, nothing that you're saying is boring. I could listen to you for hours. I've taken tons of notes, and I know the viewers are going to love it too. And I mean that. Okay, so on their inflation fight, I remember like at the beginning of the year, the expectation was like six cuts. I think now it's maybe like a cut of 25 basis points. I know it's hard to say, or no one knows the answer, but how are you thinking about the Fed and their interest rate policy if we'll see any cuts?
Well, when the, I don't remember if it was this last FOMC meeting, I think it was, where Powell, I think he basically said, you know, and we don't really need to see employment rise, we just need to see inflation come down. And I sort of felt like if they were to cut rates, it might start a real speculative orgy in the markets. Now, the data hasn't been friendly enough to allow them to do that. I don't know how the data is going to sort out, and how, like I say, how willing they're going to be to look past the fact that what they expected to see, they haven't really seen. I don't think they're going to get, should they cut? No. Will they cut? Maybe. If they cut, I actually kind of hope that they do, because I've been a critic of them for so long, and I don't see how they have any credibility. I would like them to make this obvious mistake, and then I would like the bond market to do what I described earlier in our conversation and make it clear, pardon me, that the Fed had lost the confidence of the long end of the bond market. That would start to take the punch bowl away, start to take the printing press away, and that would, the ramification would be, oh my, we would have to do something about deficits and all of that, which means it'd have to get pretty ugly out there for that conversation to take place, because as you can see, the politicians we have these days don't do anything except make matters worse. So yeah. I don't think the Fed should cut. Will they get some data to allow them to? I don't know. Like I said, it's bad policy, but this time I'm actually rooting for it. In the past, I rooted for the right policy. They didn't do it. They didn't pay a price. So let's let them screw up and get discredited finally for real. That's the way I'm looking at it.
Mm-hmm. You know, going back to like just the economy, I don't know, maybe it feels perplexing to me at times, because like I'm a millennial. I feel like I did all the right things. And I look at like, I want to buy a house. I like want to, you know, start the family, buy the house and all that stuff. And like, it doesn't really feel attainable right now. And I feel like a lot of folks in my generation might feel the same. So sometimes I wonder, Bill, like, is the economy a bit bifurcated? It might feel or look good for some, but maybe not for others. But
yeah,
it just doesn't feel like a healthy economy to me.
Do you want to know something? In the late 70s, early 80s, that's the way, at that moment in time, let's see, what was I? I was in my late 20s, early 30s, right? How old are you, may I ask?
I'm 30. Oh, I just turned 36 last week.
Okay, you're my daughter. I have two daughters around your age. But that was exactly how I felt and a lot of other people felt. I don't know if we'll be able to buy a house, you know? And I remember vividly, my first job was computer programming in 77, 78, somewhere around there. And I was making, I was getting $800 a month. I think that was my salary. I remember thinking, but you know, inflation is just going to eat this up. What am I going to do to protect myself from inflation? Now, I was a young guy. I hadn't studied finance much or anything like that, but it was, I knew it was a problem, and everybody knew it was a problem, because that's how we'd been trained. That's what I'm talking about, inflation psychology. But it seemed unattainable. And yes, the problem of the Fed's reckless policies is that it debases the value of a dollar slowly but surely over time. And when the flip side of that, reciprocal of that, is higher prices for homes and things like that. And it's kind of insidious. You know, people cheer the asset inflation that the irresponsible policies the Fed has pursued created, but that there's a downside to that, that pushes up home prices, right? Pushes up the cost of this, that, and the other thing. And so if you were lucky enough to accumulate wealth during the less insane period, then all of these bad policies have helped you. So people that are older than you that have, had gotten into the meat of their careers, where they're making good money and could save and invest in certain ways. Whereas millennials haven't had that chance. Obviously, you can't generalize, because some young people have had extraordinary careers, make lots of money and all that. But this is not a unique feeling you have. My generation, certain of us, had the same exact thing 40 years ago. 40? Yeah, 40. 40 plus. I don't have an answer as how to fix that, because I'm afraid that the policy of the central bank is going to be pro-inflation for some time, and it's only going to kind of get worse. only a train wreck, which we will have at some point, will dislocate the asset markets enough to have a big dip in price that could help you. On the other hand, you got to make sure that the assets that you're building up to be able to buy the house don't get impaired at the same time. So it's going to be the next year, 18 months is going to be pretty tricky, I think, once we see which way the Fed's going to go here in the next few months.
Yeah, definitely. You know, another asset you mentioned earlier, and I took some notes when you're talking about Volcker, you mentioned like the gold price and what the gold market's reaction is. Very popular topic on this channel is gold.
Okay.
And what do you think gold has been sniffing out lately? Has the movement upward surprised you at all? Just would love to put that to you as well.
You know what? That is a really, really good question. And I would say surprised me yes and surprised me no. I'll explain what I mean. So because of this box that the Fed has put us in, whereby once you do QE and you pursue ZERP or NERP, zero or negative interest rate policies like all the G7 banks, you can't ever leave that regime without immense pain, which is why they're pussyfooting around getting away from, you know, with their QT, and it's been softened up by some of the machinations that Janet Yellen has done behind the scenes that I don't really want to get into. So I've had a position in gold and silver and mining companies for some time because I've recognized that gold will do well in inflationary periods, and if the policies get more reckless and more detrimental long term, it will do even better. So for me, it was an insurance policy that could also pay dividends and grow in value. What I think that the gold markets, and so I've been surprised that it's been as docile as it's been until recently, and then all of a sudden, once we spent 5 weeks around $2,000 an ounce, then it quickly has broken out and run 15% in no time, and everyone scratched their head and saying, "Why is that?" First of all, the buyers are in Asia. The Chinese central bank has been buying gold. The Chinese public's been buying gold. The Chinese government has been encouraging its citizens to buy gold. It's almost as though the Chinese government can see that we're headed to some kind of an inflation problem leading to some sort of financial disruption, and they're trying to get their citizens to own the right thing so that they're in good stead when that happens. You know, in China, the real estate market and the stock market have not done well, and they crack down hard on crypto. So it's the one outlet that people have. The other big buyer has been India, and then the central banks, the non-G7 central banks. And I think part of that was driven by when we kind of weaponized the dollar by putting sanctions on Russia. And so that maybe made some reserve diversification seem like a good idea on the part of central banks. The problem is that, you know, there's no good currencies anymore. They all do the same thing. So, I mean, there could be some small central banks in the world that do the right thing. So gold has been the beneficiary. So the Chinese, the Indians, and the central banks are buying gold. But in North America, the ETFs have liquidated about 500 tons in the last year. It's recently gone up a little bit, but there's been liquidation. And in Europe. So why is it sprinted? I think the gold market may have figured out, and I almost brought this up as an example of a market that could see what was coming, figured out that the central bank is trapped. They can't really raise rates anymore. They can't really fight inflation. And we have a government that won't stop the massive deficits. So at some point, push is going to have to come to shove. And either they're going to have to like bite the bullet. We're going to have a lot of austerity and real pain, which sometimes gold does well because of the financial scares that develop in that kind of an environment, or we're going to have more inflation because the Fed decides to monetize bonds again. Maybe we'll have yield curve control like they did in Japan. So I think there's a possibility that the gold market is smelling out what's coming next, right? Because there's no passive bid there. There are only people like, you know, me that have gray hair and other people that, you know, a lot of people see the same things coming that I see. And they own coins, cryptos. So maybe maybe enough of the world is seeing the fact that the central banks are trapped and they're starting to prepare. And now, you know, gold hit a nerve and we had a huge run. And now this is the start of a big, big leg, which could easily be the case. So that's my long answer to your question.
It's all good. Are you into cryptos?
No.
Okay. If I don't ask you this, my audience will call me out in the comment section. You mentioned silver. Okay. They always want to hear about silver. What's the take on silver?
Okay, so I have been super bullish on silver. I was so bullish in the mid-90s, but I was at least 5 years early. I wound up trying to find a silver company to invest in. I couldn't find any. I found Pan American Silver, and I bugged the founder about it enough times that he finally said, you know as much about this as anybody else. Why don't you come join us on our board, which I did. And I wound up becoming the lead director at Pan American Silver. And I was there from like around 96 to 2011 or 12 when I stepped off the board. Because silver had gone to 40. Pan American had gone from $3 or $4 to 40. I sort of felt like I'd seen everything and we moved on. I'm bullish on silver. Finding a good silver equity is much harder than a good gold company. That's hard enough. Finding a good silver, a quality silver investment is even harder. But silver is harder to own as from a physical standpoint if you want to put a lot of money in it because it takes up so much more space than gold. But when silver gets rolling, it makes Bitcoin look tame. You know what I mean? I have a good friend of mine who was the biggest local on the COMEX trading silver in the 90s. And I know some other guys that traded. And we used to refer to silver as it's just a personality, not really a market. So when silver heats up and starts going, because it's thin, it's not a big market, it really can run. So I think we will see a big period in silver. A lot of people have the idea that, well, I got to protect myself. They think gold's too expensive because it's $2,300 an ounce. And so silver's cheaper because it's, you know, $28 an ounce. Well, there's a reason for those discrepancies, but nevertheless, people want to buy 100 ounces or 10 ounces or a round number. So silver gets bid by default. Silver will go up far, far more than gold. I think we're going to be in a good period for both of those two over the next year to year and a half. But there are a lot more silver companies that are bad investments, even though they might go up in price. So you have to be really careful.
Let me ask you one final question. I'm looking at the U.S. national debt, $34.6 trillion, and it's ticking higher. It's just ripping higher.
Yep.
We were talking about the deficit problem. What's kind of your outlook on the U.S., given kind of it's a bit messy out there, especially like our fiscal picture does not look good. What is kind of your, maybe it's a bit of a longer term outlook. How are you thinking about it?
I mean, look, we've gotten away with murder for way too long. You know, the Federal Reserve enabled can kicking. The government's been can kicking and raising the debt ceiling every year for, as long as I can remember. I remember the first debt ceiling hike in 89. I know there were some before then, but I was so disappointed when they did that in 89 because I thought, you know, they could maybe, you know, set the tone for the future. But so Congress doesn't, there's not, well, maybe there's a few. Essentially, no one in Congress cares about the debt or the deficit. They figure that's our problem, not theirs. You can see how self-serving most of these people are. They speculate on stocks. I mean, when they're passing legislation that might in fact impact industries, they gaslight like crazy. They lie. The media lets them lie. So we elect these people that are complete scum. And they're not going to do a hard thing. You think they're going to say, look, we're all going to have austerity. You people on Social Security, we got to cut your benefits. You know, you kids, we're going to do this. I mean, you know, Stan Druckenmiller about 10 years ago, who was one of the smartest and best investors of all time, tried to go on a college tour to convince kids, hey, look, you guys got to do something about this. And it's because it's really hard to get people focused and to say we got to take this strong medicine because if we don't, in 10 years, there's going to be problems. People say, well, why don't we deal with it in 8.5 years from now? That's the nature of the beast. We had a tremendous opportunity after the 2008 banking crisis brought on by the real estate bubble. I hate when people call it the great financial crisis or whatever they call it. That's a trite name that's just crap. You got to call it what it is so you understand what happened. The financial system came about an inch away from being vaporized, and people were scared. And in that moment, had we had a real leader, we possibly could have made the tough decisions. I had hoped that would happen. Barack Obama was pathetic when it came to anything related to finance. Not that any of the rest of these guys have been any better, but that was a moment where they could have done some sound things and put us on a firmer footing, and they didn't. And it's only gotten worse. And now these politicians don't think there's any consequence to any amount of irresponsibility. I mean, you got the, so you have to ask yourself, how big is the crisis going to have to be to force them to try to deal with this? And I would say it's got to be really big. So you can't look at anything about the finances of this country and feel confident at all. There's going to have to be some kind of a train wreck. We will get it. I don't know what it will be. And in that moment, if we have the right leader, perhaps we will settle up. Otherwise, it'll be a lot of inflation for a really long time. So I don't know how it's going to play out. We'll have to see how events go. But it's a real problem, and the setup is not constructive at all.
And I have to say, Bill, I've really enjoyed having you on and listening to you, learning from you. Before I let you go, I want to hand it back to you. Do you want to let folks know where they can, you know, find some of your work? Any parting thoughts for the folks watching and listening?
My parting thought in, you know, trying to be helpful is, a lot of the things I've said may sound a little bit, nah, we don't need to worry about it. I would encourage you to get your arms around all these things I've discussed. They will matter. That doesn't mean they're going to matter tomorrow, but you need to be aware of what's out there. So if something starts to come along, you think, ooh, that could trip one of those things. You're aware of it. You can follow the thread and you say, oh, geez, I have to cut my equity exposure. I have to increase my gold exposure. I got to decrease both, whatever. So you need to, you have to understand the rules of the game that you're playing. These aren't exactly rules, but these are the variables that matter. So that's what I would encourage people to do, especially if they're, you know, young like you are and have their whole futures in front of them. I mean, the fewer mistakes you can make that cost you a lot of money, the better you'll be. Making mistakes is okay. We all make them. And usually they cost you money, but that's the tuition that you are paying to get better at investing. And nobody gets there without paying the tuition. Some just pay less than others. So that would be my preaching, so to speak. I've been writing a financial column describing the market action and answering questions since 1996. I started as a lark just to see what was happening on the internet. And I started writing for this internet portal. Anyway, I have my own website. It's FleckensteinCapital.com. It's $130 a year. I describe what goes on in the market, whatever interests me. Sometimes I write a lot. Sometimes I write a little. I talk about what I'm investing in, and I answer questions. So if that sounds like something anyone cares about, they know where to find me. I have a Twitter handle. It's at FleckCap. I don't say anything very important there. I mostly take shots at things, but there it is. So that's my presence in the world.
I love it. We'll link to those. Well, Bill Fleckenstein, founder and president of Fleckenstein Capital, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, your ideas, all of your knowledge and wisdom. I really appreciate you, and you are welcome back on this channel anytime. Really enjoyed the discussion.
You asked very serious and thoughtful questions, and anytime you want to have me back, I'll be happy to come back.
I would be honored. Thank you so much, Bill. I really appreciate it.